From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carol Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. We have such a good show for you today. William Safire, the renowned language expert, political pundit, and one-time speechwriter for President Nixon will be our guest to play Not My Job. We'll finally be able to get the answer to the question that's been burning within us for years. Was Spiro Agnew as kind as he was handsome? But first, we've got some questions for you. Give us a call. The number is 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. It's time to welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Gloria Dunlap from Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
How are things in beautiful Winston-Salem?
They are quite nice today, actually.
I'm glad to hear it. What do you do there?
I actually work in the neighboring town of Greensboro as a project manager for a not-for-profit organization.
I see. That's very well-meaning.
Okay. I do what I can.
Do you mean well?
Yes, yes, I do mean well most of the time.
Great. That would be required. Welcome to our show, Gloria. Let me introduce you to our panel this week. First, say hello. It's an author and a writer for HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, Mr. Adam Felber.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, Gloria.
Also say hello to a deputy editor and blogger for the Houston Chronicle, Ms. Kiri O'Connor.
Hi, Kiri.
Hi, Gloria.
And lastly, it's a humorist, author, and the man responsible for just about everything you will find at TomBaudette.com, Mr. Tom Baudette.
Hello, Gloria.
Gloria, welcome to our show. You're going to start us off with Who's Carl This Time? Carl Castle will recreate for you three quotations from the week's news. Your job, correctly identify or explain just two of them. Do that, you'll win our prize. Carl's voice on your very own home answering device. Ready to play?
Yes, I am.
All right, here's your first quote.
The results didn't signal the end, but they did signal more than the beginning of the end. It's the intermission in the middle of the beginning of the end.
That was John Dickerson of Slate.com doing his best to find some glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel. Actually, I guess he's just trying to find the tunnel. He was talking about the results of what this week?
The primaries in Oregon and Kentucky.
Very good. The new Democratic primaries. Yes. The Democratic primary for president is over. Everybody agrees that with his victory in Oregon on Tuesday, Barack Obama has won the majority of pledged delegates. He will be the nominee. Well, almost everybody agrees. Hillary Clinton is still out there. She's coming up with more and more elaborate arguments to justify her staying in the race. Her latest is, if you count the primaries from Michigan and Florida, which she once agreed not to count before she realized that she would need them, if you count those two states, then she is a majority of the popular vote, sort of. This week, she compared the struggle to count those votes to the struggle to end slavery, seriously. And then she said that not counting the Florida votes was just like what's going on right now in the violently disputed election in Zimbabwe, which is surprising, because last we heard, rival tribes of retired Jews in Boca Raton were not burning down their condominium complexes. Though it would be cool if they did, yes. I have to say.
They are saying vicious things to each other over the buffet, though.
That's true.
Very thinly veiled insults.
Here's your next quote. It's from insiders at the McCain campaign, as reported on CNN.
He's grilling. He loves to grill.
The senator is having a barbecue at his house this weekend, an event that many people think is an audition process for what job?
Vice president?
Exactly right. Among the guests at this weekend's barbecue will be his senior advisors and closest friends, plus three potential vice presidents. Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, Governor Charlie Crist of Florida, and according to some reports, former Governor Mitt Romney of Massachusetts will be there. That's a little surprising, because back during the Republican primary, it was widely known that McCain thought Romney was a weenie.
Weenie is putting it mildly.
I know.
Yeah. You think he'll wear a tie to the barbecue?
I hope so. He would,
yeah,
wouldn't he?
Yeah, totally would, yeah.
Now, it seems odd to us to consider people for a very important job during a single mass social engagement, so we decided to consult an expert on this, get some advice, perhaps, for the senator. We're pleased to welcome now P.J. Osgood, director of It's Just Lunch, which is a dating and matchmaking service. P.J., welcome to Wait, Wait.
Thank you for having me on, Peter.
It's great to have you. Now, this is a big decision, who will be the vice presidential nominee. And McCain only has a short amount of time with each candidate during this barbecue. So what's the best way, given those limits, do you think, for them to really get to know each other?
The very first thing I would tell them to do is, you know, obviously ask open-ended questions. I'd love to, for him to ask each prospective vice president how their trip was. Let's see if they go right to the negative. But after that, I think he's got to take each one of those guys out there and start canoeing.
Canoeing?
Yeah.
Who's tending the grill?
I'm sure they're going to have someone doing the grilling.
So you think that it's important for McCain and the candidate to get in a small enclosed space where neither can escape, out in the water, and row around just so they can really spend some quality time together?
Well, I think it tells you a lot. I mean, I don't think I have my clients actually going canoeing, but when you only have a certain amount of time to determine whether or not this relationship's going to work, there's nothing like being in a small space where neither one of those Republicans want to tip over or get wet. And someone's in the back canoeing, and someone's got to be the eyes. So the guy in the front's got to tell you where to go, and the guy in the back has got to do the work. So
that's an interesting idea. Now, let me ask you a question. I mean, to go with the dating analogy, McCain is a total babe.
Oh, yeah.
Metaphorically speaking. And they're going to do whatever they can to please him. So how will McCain know... How will he get through their sales pitch? How will he see their real personalities behind what they're saying? Is there a way to get through the facade?
Well, you know what? The thing I would do is you got to put them in a situation where they're all sort of competing at the same time. So I would tell them, you know, McCain's out there and we're getting, you know, he's grilling or having someone grill. I'd have those three guys in there in the kitchen. Each one of them's got to make a side for dinner.
Wow.
Yeah, you know what? Listen, if they're going to get stressed out about, you know, the mashed potatoes or stressed out about their... I mean, they can't handle this job.
Give them a small test, see how they handle it, see what kind of reveals about
so
them.
So this could all be riding on whether or not Charlie Crist can make potato salad?
Yeah.
You know what?
Elections have been won on dumber things.
Mm-hmm. PJ Osgood is the director of It's Just Lunch, a dating and matchmaking service. PJ, thank you so much for your advice.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye. Gloria, here is your last quote.
Next up, $5 per laboratory visit.
That was Kevin Drum at the Washington Monthly blog. He's wondering what will be the next airline fee now that American has decided to charge flyers $15 to handle the first what?
Bag they check.
Yes, an outrage. An outrage, yes. Just when you thought that air travel could not get any awesomer. American Airlines this week became the first airline to charge passengers for any checked luggage. Americans will start charging in June. It's a move expected to generate millions in revenue for American, but of course people will start avoiding checking their luggage and start trying to squeeze duffel bags into the seat backs. It'll be chaos, according to one industry analyst. Another proposed plan, the airlines will charge you a set fare to fly you to your destination and then collect an additional fee to let you off the plane.
Having sat at the tarmac so frequently at LAX, I would pay that fee.
Really?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's money they're leaving on the table, I think.
Yeah, they really are. No.
Do you think it's fair that they might be charging for check luggage?
I actually don't think they're charging enough. I've been trying to convince my dear spouse, and please forgive me, sweetie, that she didn't need three bags to go overnight somewhere. And I think if they charge like $150, we could get her down to a bag.
Tom, she's already not going to forgive you.
Yeah. No, I know.
That's too late. That was already... Yeah.
Carl, how did Gloria do in our quiz?
Gloria did very well, Peter. Gloria, you had three correct answers, so I'll be doing the message on your home answering machine.
You know, that makes her Gloria in excelsis.
That's true. Mm.
Yes.
Well done, Gloria. Thank you so much. Right now, panel, time for you to answer some questions about this week's news. Adam, the New York Yankees, as you might have been aware, are off to a terrible start this season.
Yes, indeed.
And are looking for any help they can find to turn things around. Well, first baseman Jason Giambi recently revealed that he's provided his team with a surefire slump buster. What?
I'm just guessing it's not going to help. So, the Wii Fit game?
No. it's something he wears, something he's offered his other teammates to wear to help them out.
Undergarments.
Yes, but what kind of undergarment?
Magical magnetic ones.
He's even more attractive.
It's girdle.
No, to break out of his slumps, Jason Giambi wears under his uniform a shiny gold lamé tiger print thong.
Oh, thanks for that visual.
Yeah. You're kidding me.
Well, baseball players, as you know, are superstitious. They have their rituals in the batter's box.
Yeah.
Apparently, some players wear ladies' underpants for good luck. Giambi told Portfolio...
Well, I would.
Yes, well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Giambi told Portfolio magazine that he has used his lucky thong for 12 years. He's even loaned it out to numerous teammates, including Derek Jeter, Johnny Damon. Giambi says, quote, all of them wore it and got hits. The thong works every time.
Hey, Jason, can I borrow your thong tonight? I love it.
But since he came out with this, if you will, other players have come forward with their own exotic slump-busting stratagems. Red Sox slugger David Ortiz will occasionally wear purple pasties under his jersey.
No.
Mets pitcher Johan Santana wears support hose. And this is the best one. Yankees MVP Alex Rodriguez admits sometimes when he needs an extra boost of luck, he'll put on men's underwear.
That was a true Red Sox fan. We really split on partisan lines right there.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight.
Right now, it's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game in the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Michael Goldstoff from Niskayuna, New York.
Niskayuna, New York?
Yes, it is.
Where is... where is Niskayuna?
Niskayuna is the town just next to Schenectady.
Niskayuna, next to Schenectady.
It's next to Schenectady.
So you're doomed to say the phrase next to Schenectady quite frequently.
Well, most of the time we say near Albany.
Well, that's not nearly as much fun.
I'm sorry.
Welcome to our show, Michael. You're going to play the game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Michael's topic?
At long last, Wait, Wait, have you no decency?
We got a remarkable email this week. It was from someone who was involved in a news story that he feared would end up on our show. And he was asking us for mercy. Well, he was right. We knew about the story, and we were already getting our cruel jokes ready. So instead, each of our panelists are going to describe three individuals who made some news this week, and then very much wanted us to be at least kind about it on our show. Your job, pick the real story, and you'll win Carl's voice on your home answering machine. First, let's hear from Tom Baudet.
If you've ever fooled around with a homemade half-inch PVC blowgun and accidentally killed your wife's beloved chihuahua with a Vicodin-tipped dart, you'll understand why John Goodhue of Nancyville, Ohio, would try to cover up the crime. By placing the dearly departed Jiggy behind the rear wheel of his wife's parked car, he hoped to make it appear as if she'd killed it herself. The ruse may have actually worked had he been able to summon a more appropriate reaction to his wife's hysterical shrieking than, "I never liked that nervous little dog anyway," or bothered to remove the dart. Sworn public testimony during the divorce proceedings revealed that Goodhue's intent was not to murder the animal. "Jiggy never stood still for more than 5 seconds in a row," he explained. "I was just trying to calm him down for a while." The newly single Goodhue begged Wait, Wait to ignore this otherwise local story, saying, "It's not the sort of thing I'd put in my Match.com profile, if you know what I mean."
A man afraid you'll make fun of the way he sort of accidentally dispatched his wife's dog. Your next story of a listener begging us to go easy on them comes from Kerry O'Connor.
So Harvey Epstein, owner of Mamacita's restaurant in Boulder, Colorado, wrote in to say, in essence, "Don't tease me, bro." Mr. Epstein says that he was only defending his mother, who happened to be standing outside the restaurant when Mr. Epstein got into an argument with a security guard over a parked van. And when the guard whipped out his taser gun, Mr. Epstein had only one choice. He whipped out his own taser, and in a kind of 21st century version of High Noon, the two men simultaneously tased each other. And then, we presume, simultaneously fell to the ground and flopped around like fish. Police called it, quote, a bonehead deal. And both men were released without needing any medical attention. And what was the first thing Mr. Epstein thought of? Not his mother or his van, but what we on this show would say about him. He wrote in to say that he loves our show, but, quote, my wife is sure I will be mentioned and mocked. Sorry, dude.
Taser fight in the OK parking lot. Your last story of someone asking us to be kind comes from Adam Felber.
Our fan Nick Grad writes, I know that when you burn your own garage down while fleeing a wild animal that you attracted, it sounds pretty bad, but I can explain. Well, you don't have to, Nick, because the Burlington Free Press has done a great job. It seems that Grad was working on the roof of the garage behind his house when his cell phone rang, setting off a bizarre chain of events. Nick attempted to answer the phone, dropped it into the rain gutter, tried to reach for it rather than climbing down and moving the ladder, and promptly fell to earth, badly spraining his ankle. That's when he noticed the bear. Nick limped to the garage and attempted to call for help when he remembered that his phone was still up there in the gutter. Thinking fast, Nick fashioned a torch out of a broom and a rag and attempted to wave the bear off with fire. As the bear retreated, Nick noticed that his sleeve was now on fire, so he retreated back into the garage, dropped and rolled, which extinguished Nick and ignited the garage. Go easy on me, Nick counsels. Nobody could make me feel worse about this than my daughter, who has not stopped laughing since Sunday.
So, one of these people preemptively, or at least tried, to soften our coverage of their story. Was it from Tom Baudet, a man who accidentally killed his wife's chihuahua while trying to tranquilize it? From Kerry O'Connor, a man who got into a taser fight and managed to simultaneously tase and be tased? Or from Adam Felber, a man who managed to set his own garage on fire after spraining his leg, answering a cell phone call, and scaring off a bear? Which of these is the real story which someone tried to keep us from mentioning now?
This is hard. I don't think Tom's is correct.
You don't?
I don't think that. I don't think they would admit to that.
Okay.
And Adam sounds like just too many steps that go wrong in a row. I know that could happen, but I think I'm going to go with Kiri's.
You're going to go with Kiri's story of the dual tasers, taser drawdown. All right.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, the person to tell us which is true is the person himself. Here he is.
I'm Harvey Epstein. I wrote a letter about the taser incident, hoping Wait wouldn't make fun of me. All I ever wanted was Carl Castle's voice on my answering machine.
That was Harvey Epstein from Boulder, Colorado. He sent us an email, the subject title which was, Help, I'm that taser guy in the news. That's what you get for asking us for mercy. Congratulations, you got it right. You're at a point for Kiri. You've won our prize. Carl Castle recorded the greeting on your home answering machine. And what happens to Harvey, I guess, is between him and Carl. Thank you so much for playing.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye.
And now the game where we ask people who've spent their lives becoming experts in one area. We ask them questions about something else entirely. We call it Not My Job. For more than 30 years, William Safire of the New York Times was the preeminent political pundit in journalism. He retired from that role 3 years ago, but has continued to write his weekly column on language. He's just put out the latest edition of Safire's Political Dictionary, which includes words and phrases from the 2008 presidential campaign. William Safire, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Gee, that's a lot of people listening in on a phone call.
I know, it's great.
Yeah, it's like the Bush administration.
Yeah. That goes back to the Nixon administration.
Yeah, sure. As a matter of fact, you mentioned that, of course, your start in politics was as a speechwriter for President Nixon. But prior to that, you arranged the famous Nixon-Khrushchev kitchen debate in Moscow. I guess it was like 1958. Am I getting that date right?
1959, and it was my kitchen.
Yes, that was the thing. That you arranged it not as a representative of Nixon, but...
Right, I was the press agent for the typical American house that was being shown in the American exhibition in Moscow. And Nixon and Khrushchev were walking around, and I managed to get them into my kitchen, and they had their debate there.
I love this, that you're not working for in the kitchen debate between Nixon and Khrushchev. You're not working for Nixon. You're not working for Khrushchev. You're working for the kitchen.
Exactly. And after it was over, Nixon came over to me and said, we really put that kitchen on the map for you, and how'd you like to work on my campaign?
So you did. You worked for Nixon pretty much through the 60s. Through, you left office before he did, if I'm not mistaken.
Just in the nick of time.
In the nick of time. Now, you've written fondly about him, particularly as a political mind over the years. I mean, as you know, President Nixon doesn't have maybe the best reputation these days. Tell us something you knew about him that we don't know.
Well, he was a great man for a comeback, and he came back after being defeated twice in California and after the Nixon-Kennedy campaign, and then after his downfall, made a comeback again, and he was the only one, I think, to have 6 books on the New York Times bestseller list.
Really?
And he wrote them himself.
Did he really?
How do you like that?
I like it fine. As a speechwriter, your career, you were mostly well known not so much for what you wrote for the president, but what you wrote for the vice president, Spiro Agnew. And one of your famous contributions to political discourse, as you say in your own dictionary, was his immortal phrase, "nattering nabobs of negativism."
Hey, you got the pronunciation of nabobs correct.
Thank you.
Very few people do that. They all say nabobs, and they're wrong.
No. Apparently, you meant that as a joke, this kind of elaborate alliteration. It wasn't the only alliteration you gave him in that speech.
Well, Nixon loaned a few of his speechwriters, like Pat Buchanan and Bryce Harlow and myself, to Agnew for the midterm campaign in 1970, and told us, go out there and crack the elitists. And so I submitted a couple of alliterative phrases, because alliteration kind of goes in politics. And I gave 2 to Vice President Agnew. One was the nattering nabobs of negativism. And the other one...
He was describing the media and the elites in the East Coast.
Well, that we were describing the defeatists, the
right.
Prophets of gloom and doom, as
right.
Eisenhower once said. And then I also gave him the hopeless, hysterical hypochondriacs of history.
I don't think that one took off.
No,
no, it didn't take off because there was an objection from the 4-H clubs.
And justifiably so.
Wow. Now you went off, you left the Nixon White House, you became a conservative op-ed writer for the New York Times.
Right, I was the resident right winger there.
Yes. And did they always make you sit by yourself at the company picnics, or were you well?
It was a little lonely there for a while, but then I did go to a picnic, and one of the kids for one of the reporters fell in the pool, and my wife, who was standing next to me, pushed me into the pool fully clothed, and so I fished the kid out, and we both came out dripping, and all of a sudden I was a hero at the picnic. And
wait a minute. You're telling me that you went to the New York Times, you were a member of the Nixon White House, you were a conservative, they didn't trust you, and then you saved the life of a child in front of the collected staff, so they had to accept you?
It was a big break.
Yeah.
And there are some who say that kid did not fall in the pool.
I was about to say.
I've looked at that film over and over and over.
You can see him go back into the left. Back into the left.
I think there's a third sapphire at the picnic table.
G. Gordon Liddy pushed the kid.
That's amazing. I had not heard that. That's a great story. Well, William Sapphire, it is a pleasure to have you here with us. We have asked you here to play a game that this week we are calling
You're Above the Law, Hard to Kill, Marked for Death, and Out for Justice.
As I'm sure you know, those were the first 4 films starring action hero, auteur, and martial arts master Steven Seagal. No relation.
The guy with the hair in the back.
The guy with the hair, yeah. Mr. Seagal has finally received his due, not an Oscar, not yet, but a scholarly book devoted to his oeuvre titled Seagalology, A Study of the Ass-Kicking Films of Steven Seagal. So we're going to ask you 3 questions about Mr. Seagal. If you answer 2 correctly, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is William Sapphire playing for?
He is playing for Aaron Schubel of San Diego, California.
First question. You ready to do this?
You fire away.
All right, first question. Despite his tough exterior, Mr. Seagal is actually a pretty sensitive guy. He was once spotted by a Warner Brothers executive weeping in his trailer. Why did Mr. Seagal say he was crying? Was it A, he was reading the most incredible script he'd ever read in his entire life, which he also just happened to have written? B, he was weeping over the sad fate of the live cultures in his strawberry banana yogurt? Or C, that scene where the mouse gets separated from his family in the animated movie Fievel Goes West always gets to him?
A.
You're going to go for A. He was
absolutely
reading the most incredible script. You're absolutely certain?
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Have you been moved to tears by your own work, sir?
Oh, of course. I completely identified with him in that.
All right. Mr. Seagal did write that script. It was never made into a film, unlike the other scripts he wrote for movies like Shadow Man, Into the Sun, Belly of the Beast. They all came out in theaters. Next question.
I just would love to have seen that moment. It's so sad. It's like he's a one-man army.
And then he puts his fist right through the guy.
Yeah. He improvises an explosive.
Next question. In addition to being a successful film actor, writer, and director, Mr. Seagal has claimed many other accomplishments, including which of these? A, he is an innovative gourmet chef, the recipient of a Medal of Honor from the French Cordon Bleu Cooking School. B, he is one of the people selected by an elite alien race, he says, to receive their communications on this earth. Or C, he is the reincarnation of an ancient Tibetan Buddhist holy monk.
Well, it can't be A because the previous one was A, and you wouldn't have two in a row.
You did really well in your SATs, didn't you, sir?
Funny thing, I used to play that game.
Right.
So I would say C.
You're going to go for C. He is the reincarnation of an ancient Tibetan Buddhist holy monk. You're right again. Steven Seagal was recognized by his teacher in Buddhism as a tulku, or reincarnation, of the, quote, 17th century hidden treasure revealer, Kyungbrag Drodre.
There's a Buddhist instructor who knows what side his bread is buttered on.
There you go, you know. So Mr. Seagal has got that going for him. All right. Let's see if you can do this perfectly. We'll turn our attention to the movies themselves. Which of these is a real bit of witty dialogue from a Steven Seagal movie? Is it A, bad guy, you can take that to the bank. Seagal, I'm going to take you to the bank, the blood bank. Is it B, love interest, wow, that was some move you put on that guy. Seagal, I've got another one I want to show you later. It's called the horizontal striking serpent. Or C, chief villain, you have defeated me at every turn. What is it that you want? Seagal, I want to feed you your own small intestine and hear you say, yum.
Well, let's see. We had an A and a C. So I'll pick B.
You're going to pick B out of pure pattern recognition. That's all you're using here. You're going to pick... No, I'm afraid the answer was A, the immortal blood bank exchange that takes place in the movie Hard to Kill from 1990, as I'm sure you, sir, remember. So, Carl, how did William Sapphire do in our show?
Well enough, Peter. He had two correct answers, so he wins for Aaron Schubel.
Congratulations, sir. Well done.
Well, I'm delighted.
William Sapphire is a veteran columnist for the New York Times. You can read his column on language every Sunday in the magazine. He has also come out with an updated version of his classic, Sapphire's Political Dictionary, now from Oxford Press. William Sapphire, thank you so much for being with us today.
Greatly.
Thank you all. In just a minute, Carl puts pen to pad and composes lyrical verse inspired by the week's news in our Listener Limerick Challenge. If you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Right now, though, panel, some more questions for you from the week's news. Tom, this week, President Bush's senior advisor on ethics and morality released... He has one.
Seriously.
He does. That's not the joke. He released an official report on things that he finds immoral. Such as what? What was his example of things that he finds immoral or disgusting?
Immoral. Boy, I mean, I'm looking at the things he's overlooked and trying to think of what's possibly left. Can I have a hint?
Well, you can find this gentleman. His name is Leon Cass. You can find him chasing good humor trucks with a pitchfork.
Oh, eating, no, seriously, eating ice cream?
Eating ice cream.
Is it immoral?
Let me explain.
It's my last vice.
Let me explain. Leon Kass is the man who is the head of the President's Council on Bioethics. He was appointed to the post by President Bush, and he is extremely concerned with the concept of human dignity. He thinks it is profoundly undignified for humans, people, to lick ice cream cones. He says it is, quote, a cat-like... I'm going to tell you what he says.
Oh, boy.
He says it is, quote, a cat-like activity that has been made acceptable in informal America, but that still offends those who know eating in public is offensive. He goes on. This dog-like feeding, if one must engage in it, ought to be kept from public view, where, even if we feel no shame, others would not be compelled to witness our shameful behavior, unquote.
What's this guy's title?
He is the head of the President's Council on Bioethics.
Bioethics. Yeah. So he's a scientist.
He's not per se a scientist. He is a philosopher.
Not so much a scientist as a Taliban.
It is true, though, that the President accepted this report and announced that if Ben and Jerry do not disarm, he will be forced to invade Vermont.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Kira, you might win some fabulous prizes, including an iPod, a Starbucks gift certificate, or even $1 million in cash if a plan goes through and you decide to participate in what?
I'm guessing this is something that I probably ought to participate in.
Something you're required to participate in.
Required? Oh, pay my taxes?
No.
No?
You don't get anything for that.
No?
Well, doing your civic duty and getting nothing in return is so 1980 or 1990 or 2000.
My civic duty?
In those years.
Oh, census?
Yes. Participating in the U.S. Census. Every household in the United States will be eligible for the U.S. Census Prize Patrol. If the Commerce Department... I'm Ed McMahon, and I'm here from the census.
That's just where I went.
Yes. If the Commerce Department decides to go ahead...
How many people are in your house? Four.
How many toilets do you have?
This is a plan. It was advanced by Senator Tom Coburn. He suggests the census should start offering prizes in 2010. Because even giving away $1 million in iPods or whatever, it would be cheaper than chasing the 33% of households who didn't return the questionnaires back in 2000.
If they know exactly how many people didn't return the questionnaires, then they don't need them.
That's a good point. Opposition to this plan says it would turn the census into a lottery ticket and isn't what, quote, Thomas Jefferson had in mind, unquote. The hope, though, is that if this works, if all of a sudden, because offering cheap prizes, people participate in government programs, other programs might try it. For example, if you join the Army, you get a $5 gift certificate to the falafel hut in the Green Zone.
Try the pita.
The triple pita patty.
The triple pita patty.
Tom, a British woman was surprised and a little annoyed to discover that thieves who had stolen her debit card had used it to do what?
What would be more annoying than just using it? Could I have a hint?
Well, it was particularly annoying because this is true. She's a Hillary supporter.
Oh, to donate to the Barack Obama campaign.
That's exactly what happened. Barack Obama may have trouble reaching those white working class voters in Appalachia, but apparently he is winning over the British pickpocket demographic. The victim, Tanya Parker, was not amused. She told The Sun, quote, "It's crazy. I couldn't believe it. I'm not even an Obama fan. I prefer Hillary Clinton. When your card gets nicked, you expect them to buy designer jeans or jewelry, not go topping up the coffers of some foreign politician," unquote.
Who says he's not appealing to the working man?
Exactly.
You know?
But by the way, we did call up the Obama campaign and ask them for their comment on this, and they said no.
So they're not returning the money?
No. Well, I don't know if they are, but they had no comment for us. Kiri, two Belgian men have designed a video game that is not played on a television or at an arcade. Instead, this video game is played where?
In a urinal.
Yes.
How do you do that?
That was amazing.
I know that I've listened to this show before.
The designers would have called it the Nintendo Wii, but the name's been taken instead. The game is called The Place to Pee. It works like this. On either side of the urinal inside it are sensors that users aim at to activate and play the game. You can either control a skier going down a slope. You can blast aliens in outer space. At the same time, inventors in Germany came up with their own version. That's a game in which you use the same method to steer a car in the screen in front of your eyes around traffic. If you crash, it tells you that you're too drunk to drive. Of course, the fact that you're playing a video game with your urine might be a clue right there.
At the same time, this was like a Bell and
Marconi
deal.
Yeah, I know. It's really amazing.
It's amazing how great ideas
like Leibniz developed. And Newton inventing calculus at the same time, except in a men's room, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There may be an ulterior motive to that. Anybody who's ever been in a public men's restroom knows that accuracy is not a high priority.
No.
And if there was something more to focus on... I mean, besides the entertainment value, there could be a sanitary aspect to this, is all I'm saying.
The guy's running around ordering more pitchers of beer because, like, I think I can get the high score.
I know. That's it.
The game would favor the fuller bladdered.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, and the poor guy with the enlarged prostate. You know? He's like, oh, I can never get past level one.
Coming up, it's lightning fill in the blank, but first it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. You can send an email to waitwait@npr.org. You can also go to our website at waitwait.npr.org, where you can find out about attending our weekly live shows here at the Chase Auditorium in Chicago, and download the Wait Wait podcast for your computer or MP3 player. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Joyce in Rockville, Maryland.
Hey, how are things in Rockville?
Oh, nice. We had good weather today.
That's great. I just remember REM telling me don't go back to Rockville, so I never have. So,
well, you're missing something. It's
a
nice place.
Is it a great place? Is it a good place to be from?
Yep.
That's great. Well, welcome to our show, Joyce. You are going to play the game we call the Listener Limerick Challenge. Carl Castle will now read you three news-related limericks. The last word or phrase will be missing. Your job, complete it. 2 times out of 3, you do that, you win our prize. Ready to go?
Yep.
All right, here's your first limerick.
Can computers help love? One spawned mine. And so far this fling has gone fine. Since the year 82, we have said, I love you. We're the first couple meeting...
online.
Exactly right. This was celebrated this week because exactly 25 years ago, 1982, back when cell phones were what you used to call someone to put up bail for you... Don Dunn and Chris Jensen became the first couple ever to meet and fall in love online. They met on a primitive CompuServe chat room. After a whirlwind computer romance, Jensen flew from New York to Chicago to meet Dunn in person. It was love at first sight. He thought the tape on her glasses accentuated her eyes. He loved his game attempt to grow a mustache. By the way, they were not the first couple who wanted to get married after meeting online. Another pair of young lovebirds broke up after they met in person and discovered that they were both 55-year-old married men.
And thus the internet was really born.
Exactly. Here is your next limerick.
They may state that Karl Marx is my swami, and I call Rosa Luxemburg mommy. But a law's been retired. Now I can't be fired just because they claim I'm a...
commie.
Right, workers of the world, cheer up. Being a member of the Communist Party is no longer a fireable offense in California. The California Senate passed legislation that says that now communism is so far down in the ash heap of history it's fossilized. It's totally okay to be one, even if you're a public employee. The bill would allow for employees of the state of California to be fired for any activity to overthrow the state or government. And in a new clause added in, workers can also be fired for untoward mockery of the movies Twins and Kindergarten Cop. Very good. Here is your last limerick.
We Germans know life is most vile. A happy face hides deeper guile. And that great ode to joy, it's an unhealthy ploy. It is bad for your heart when you...
smile?
Exactly right. Remember when Mom told you to just, put on a happy face? Well, it looks like Mom had it in for you. A German psychologist is warning that forcing yourself to smile can cause excessive stress, depression, and even heart problems. Professor Dieter Zapf told a German healthcare magazine that to protect their health, professional smilers like flight attendants and shop assistants...
And the English
should take regular breaks to recuperate from the effort of smiling all the time. Have a misery break. Luckily, because of traditional German attitudes, that country isn't as much at risk as other countries, like, say, Disneyland are. So smile and the world smiles with you until you grab your chest and keel over. Carl, how did Joyce do in our quiz?
3 correct answers, Peter, so Joyce wins our prize.
Well done.
Oh, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face. Brush off the clouds and cheer up, put on a happy face. Take off the gloomy mask.
Now it's time to move on to our final game, Lightning Fill in the Blank. Each of our players now has 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill in the blank questions as they can. Each correct answer now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
Kerry O'Connor has the lead, Peter. She has 3 points. Tom Beaudet and Adam Felber are tied for second. Each has 2.
Okay. Well, we have flipped a coin, and Tom is elected to go second. So, Adam, you're up first. The clock will start when they begin your first question. Fill in the blank. A day after being diagnosed with a brain tumor, blank was released from the hospital.
Ted Kennedy.
Right. A U.S. appeals court ruled that paper money discriminates against blank.
The blind.
Right. In his appearance on Saturday Night Live, blank joked about his age.
John McCain.
Right. In the largest quarterly price decline on record, U.S. blank prices fell 1.7% in the first 3 months.
Housing.
Yes. A tractor trailer overturned in Morris, Illinois, spilling 14 tons of blank across the highway.
Oreos.
Exactly right. Double stuffed, no doubt. Ellen DeGeneres was among those who announced that they would blank now that it is legal in California.
Get married.
Yes, to her same-sex partner. With his win in the Preakness States, Big Brown is one race away from winning the blank.
The Triple Crown.
Right. Yeah. Officials in Jiak City, China are being criticized for designing a guide path for the blind that blanks.
That ends at a cliff.
No. Not quite that bad. That zigzags.
Oh.
The Chinese Business View newspaper reported that although the path features raised bumps for guidance, one section of the path has more than 10 turns in less than 20 meters. The owner of a bike repair shop nearby reported constantly seeing blind people walking into billboards and getting lost.
That wasn't really designed for the blind.
No. Well, designed for the amusement of others, I guess.
Yes.
Carl, how did Adam do in our quiz?
Adam had a great round, Peter. 7 correct answers, 14 more points.
Wow.
16
well
points and
done.
The lead.
Dominic.
That's why I wanted to go second, Adam, see if I even needed to bother to try here.
All right. Tom, you're up. Please fill in the blank. Chicago had the dubious honor of being named as the city with the highest blank prices.
Gas price.
True, because they made a technical error when presenting the bill to President Bush, the House of Representatives was forced to vote again on the blank.
The farm bill.
Right, an appeals court ruled that Texas did not have the authority to remove hundreds of blanks from a polygamous sect ranch.
Children.
Right. Japan's government has named blank as its official tourism ambassador.
Hello Kitty.
Right. Figure skater Christy Yamaguchi was the winner on this season's blank.
Dancing with the Stars.
Right. It has happened again. A police officer in Massachusetts shot himself in the pants during a blank demonstration.
A gun safety
demonstration. Of course. The police officer was demonstrating how to safely holster a weapon, which apparently includes the little-known step of shooting a hole in your pants. We have only 2 small words of advice. For gun safety trainers, leave the bullets at home. And for those attending a gun safety class, duck. Carl, how did Tom do in our quiz?
Tom had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. He now has 14, but Adam still has the lead with 16 points.
So how many then does Kerry need to win this thing?
7 correct answers.
Oh, my gosh. Here we go, Kerry. General Petraeus said that he expected to make further cuts to the number of troops in blank before he is promoted in September.
Iraq.
Right. After their takeover bid failed, Steve Ballmer announced that Microsoft was in talks to form some sort of deal with blank.
Yahoo.
Right. President Bush announced that the U.S. was easing restrictions and allowing people to send cell phones to family members in blank.
Cuba.
Right. An anonymous Democratic official told the AP that blank has secretly started his search for a running mate.
Ooh, secretly Obama.
Right. A credit card thief at a gas station tried to run away from police, but was caught when he forgot to blank as he fled.
Take his car?
No. Open the glass door before going through it.
Oh,
Lou Bonk. Lou Pearlman, the mastermind behind boy bands like blank, was sentenced to 25 years in prison for fraud.
NSYNC.
Yes. Also Backstreet Boys. Hamilton Jordan, a top aide to President Blank, died at age 63.
Carter.
Right after he bit and kicked two men in Mexico, police threw Blank into jail for assault and battery.
Bit and kicked two men in Mexico?
Mm-hmm.
Mickey Mouse.
No, an angry donkey. Blackie the donkey was having a bad day, went ballistic. Kicked and bit two men. So police, seeing a clear-cut case of assault and battery, threw that ass in jail for 3 days.
I don't think he learned his lesson.
No, said Officer Cenar Gomez of Chiapas State, around here, if someone commits a crime, they are jailed no matter who they are.
Even if they're accustomed to living in a pen.
Yes.
Right.
That'll teach him. Carl, did Kiri do well enough to win the game?
She needed 7 correct answers. She had just 6 correct answers. So with 16 points, Adam Felber is this week's champion.
Well done, sir. Well done. In just a minute, we're going to ask our panelists what will be the big story out of John McCain's vice presidential barbecue. But first, let me tell you that support for NPR comes from NPR stations. And Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. The Wallace Foundation, whose knowledge center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. And the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication. On the web at annenbergfoundation.org. Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Gotica writes our limericks. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our technical director is Robert Newhouse. Other engineers include Gary Yek, Les Dolarchik, and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is directed by Melody Kramer and produced by Mike Danforth and Emily Ecton. The senior producer of Wait, Don't Tell Me is Rod Abid. Now, panel, what will be the big story out of McCain's big vice presidential audition barbecue? Tom Baudet.
Bill Richardson, attending Barack Obama's top secret VP veggie roast next door, jumps the fence for one of McCain's grilled steaks.
Kerry O'Connor.
Charlie Crist delivers Florida, Bobby Jindal delivers Louisiana, and Mitt Romney delivers a delicious Jell-O salad.
And Adam Felber.
Mitt Romney is eliminated from consideration after initiating a game of horseshoes without removing the horse.
And if any of those things happen, panel, we'll ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you so much, Carol Castle. Thanks also to Tom Baudet, Kerry O'Connor, and Adam Felber. Thanks to all of you for listening. I am Peter Sagal. We'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.